I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Mitch Horowitz. Mitch is an editor at, Tarcher Penguin, and a writer on the occult for quite a number of years now, I take it.
Yes, sir.
And this book that we're talking about today is Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation, which is just out. And it's a very, very engaging read. I have to say it's an accomplishment. You cover such a encyclopedic amount of territory in the book that it could be quite daunting, but you make a story out of every single person that you talk about, so congratulations on that.
Thank you. I grew to love a lot of these figures for all their peculiarities. I have a great affection for them.
It is a sympathetic book. You're not, you don't advocate a particular occult theory in the book, but you're not taking them apart as being crazies and hucksters and charlatans.
Right. You know, I feel like history has already done a lot of that, and sometimes for good reason. But I really believed that the occult needed to be evaluated as part of the religious history of America. These were communities of belief that formed around some of these ideas, like spiritualism or channeling or psychical powers. And like all communities of belief, they had an influence on the country. And I thought the influence rather than the claims is what needed to be evaluated.
What is your definition of a cult?
Well, very simply, I go with the definition of a cult that really came into the Western world during the Renaissance. It means a kind of hidden or secret spirituality. It's usually associated with the pre-Christian or pre-Judaic faiths of the ancient world. It has to do with people having a direct relationship with some kind of hidden world or invisible world whose powers can be felt upon us or through us through things like prophecy or spirit channeling or mediumship or divination. A cult became kind of a catch-all phrase during the Renaissance to talk about all the forms of spirituality that belonged to the ancient world and that were sort of bubbling up again during the Renaissance as people got interested in spiritual ideas from faraway lands or from the Egyptian culture or mystical ideas that existed within the mainstream faiths, like Kabbalah, for example. The Renaissance mind was very aroused and excited by all these occult ideas, and that's when we first started to use the term occult in connection with a form of spirituality.
So alchemy might have fit into that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, part of the story here is that although the occult makes reference to pre-Christian religions and non-Christian ideas, it has a complicated relationship with Christianity. Part of your historical narrative is that it keeps weaving itself into Christianity in various ways, and eventually, you would argue, has come to dominate contemporary Christianity.
In a certain way, yes. I think that puts it very well. Occult spirituality always ran afoul of Christian churches and congregations because it belonged to none of them. It was a spirituality that existed outside the folds of any specific doctrine or sect or congregation, and that aroused a great deal of suspicion. But interestingly enough, the strongest influences in the modern world are the ones that we don't see. And in America in particular, you had a lot of people from the colonial days of this country, even up through the present, who belonged to mainstream Christian congregations but participated in occult systems, for example, the practice of spiritualism or talking to the dead, which involved spirit raps and seances and mediumship and things like that, was hugely popular in America in the mid-19th century. And if you asked a typical spiritualist, what is your religion? They might say, well, I'm a Lutheran, I'm a Methodist, I'm a Calvinist Protestant. You know, there was never any problem in America in people participating in both supernatural practices and traditional Christian beliefs. And as a result, many ideas that at one time had been quite esoteric in this country, like the power of positive thinking, for example, the idea that the mind can somehow shape outer circumstances, are today very much a part of mainstream Christian practice. Many of the evangelical media ministries, for example, draw very deeply on this positive thinking philosophy. They've stripped it, all the magical language out of it, but in the early 19th century, that was very much an occult and esoteric tradition that eventually entered the mainstream in America.
Now, you have on the cover of the book the pyramid and eye symbol from the dollar bill and also a Masonic symbol. I presume that many people picking up this book think that you're going to be talking about the influence of Freemason occultism on our founding fathers.
Yes.
And, well, and was there?
There was. What I'd like people to do and what I try to do in the book is take a fresh sounding of that Freemasonic influence on the founders, because in actuality, I think it was a very positive influence. People have all these sinister and sometimes paranoid associations with Freemasonry. But the fact is, Freemasonry was a liberal religious brotherhood that seems to have grown up in Europe in the mid-1600s. It traveled to the American colonies, where it became very popular, partly because it espoused the ideal of religious tolerance, of ecumenism. One of the main focal points of Freemasonry at its inception, one of the main principles, was the notion that people of different religious backgrounds could successfully coexist within a single organization or within a single nation. That was very arousing to the mindset in the American colonies. That was very arousing to groups of people who were breaking away from the Anglican Church. And in fact, many of our founders were Freemasons, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, Paul Revere. The influence was absolutely clear, but it was an influence that generally involved civic and religious liberalism rather than some kind of hidden control or manipulation over events.
One of the things I like about your book is that you show how malleable the political valences of occultism has been, that there's been occultism on the left and on the right. I'm reminded that Marx, when he encountered the socialist movement in the middle of the 19th century, he wrote back to Engels that it was all mixed up with different kinds of spiritualism and feminism and vegetarianism, and that everyone was just wacky over here.
Yeah.
But Colonel William Olcott, you know, a leader of anti-imperialist resistance in Asia, was a dedicated theosophist. Annie Besant was a socialist. You talk about someone that I had never heard of before, Wallace Wattles,
Yes. Who
was a dedicated Christian socialist and an occult leader. But one of the themes that comes out of that is that although they all were able to mix, for one reason or another, occultism into social reform activism, there's a contradiction in being political and occultist in that if you think that everything is the result of mental effort, then really that's not a very political message in the end.
It's interesting. It's represented a struggle in the social and religious fabric of this country. During the progressive era, the late 19th and early 20th century, as you were just describing, there were lots of people who were involved with avant-garde political movements and avant-garde religious movements. And both worlds just completely overlapped, especially with respect to spiritualism. Spiritualism, or talking to the dead, became, in a way, the first religious movement in the modern world in which women could routinely serve as leaders, in this case as spirit mediums. And in the late 19th century, you really couldn't find a suffragette activist who hadn't at least spent some time at the seance table, and vice versa. The two worlds just completely intermingled. And in particular, and this has really been lost to our history, in particular, in the early 20th century, when this positive thinking or prosperity gospel was growing up in America, there were lots of people who were social radicals who believed, and among them were Marcus Garvey, the black nationalist pioneer, and Wallace Wattles, who was a reformist minister whose work actually helped inspire the book and movie The Secret. There were lots of people who believed that some kind of a marriage was possible between social reform and occult or metaphysical politics. These people believed that the mind could be some sort of a causative, creative force in shaping the circumstances of outer life, including political life. And it seems so naive and almost foolishly idealistic today that people who wanted to break up railroad monopolies, for example, thought that you could do this with this occult mental science. And yet their ideals were they were living in an age of experiment. What seems naive to us today seemed adventuresome to them 100 years ago. And I think their efforts in many ways failed. They didn't come up with any convincing way of marrying radical or reformist politics to mystical religious ideas, occult religious ideas. But I try to capture their struggle because there was something hopeful and adventuresome and heroic in what these people were attempting. These weren't just woolly-headed people with no interest in outer life. They may seem naively idealistic today, but they were on an adventure, and that's one of the things I try to capture in the book.
I'm speaking with Mitch Horowitz about his book, Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Now, many historians of the left or social critics of the left have argued that occultism has an ineluctable connection to fascism. And you do talk about William Dudley Pelley and a couple of the other far-right occultist movements of the last 100 years. But you make a pretty strong case that Hitler himself was not an occultist. This has been one of the charges, that the Nazi movement was founded on occultism, that the swastika was an occult symbol, and that Hitler was, like in the movies, that he was sending out, you know, Nazi spies to try to track down the Holy Grail and whatnot. You say that that's not poppycock.
I think it's been heavily, heavily exaggerated. The Third Reich is one of these aspects of history onto which people project all kinds of fears and concerns, and also, you know, perverse titillations. I mean, I'm disturbed at the extent to which people just have this fascination around the religious or political ideals that they think were underlying the Third Reich, rather than people talking about trying to learn about the very authentic influences of occult ideas on Gandhi when he was young. There's a much greater and easier level of fascination that galvanizes around the Third Reich. But, you know, I try to weigh it on the balance in the book. There's no question that some of the symbols that the early Nazi movement embraced probably came to their attention through some occult and arcane journals that were being published in Europe in the early 20th century. But the influence, I think, has been vastly exaggerated, vastly overstated.
Oh, I have a question about Arthur Bell. He was one of the far-right occultists that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Is he at all a connection to Art Bell, our contemporary conspiracy theory radio host?
No. None that I've ever found. That's an interesting question. No, I think Art Bell is a pretty good guy.
But, yeah.
Arthur Bell was a figure here in the United States who did combine fascist and racist ideologies with occult politics, and there were such people here in America, and Arthur Bell was quite successful at creating a kind of conspiracy cult called Mankind United during the 1930s, and he eventually came under the scrutiny of the federal government because he was considered a Nazi sympathizer.
Yeah, during World War II, you say that a lot of heavy heat came down on these various far-right occult organizations. So.
Yes. The federal government was very concerned at the outset of the Second World War that a few of these occult fascistic sects and cults that had grown up in America might serve as some kind of a fifth column if there was ever an Axis invasion of California, for example, where some of these groups were based. There weren't very many of them, but there were a few, and at the very outset of the war, the federal government was very concerned about that.
Now, another one of the fascinating stories, which I had already known a little bit about through my study of Buddhism, was Henry Wallace's occultism, Henry Wallace being
yes.
a former vice president of FDR, and he was run for president basically by the American Communist Party in 1948 as a third or fourth party candidate
yes.
in that election. And you detail that there were concerns about his occultism from the beginning of his rise as Secretary of Agriculture, and that he did sponsor these. And again, the reason why he's of interest to Buddhists is that this guy Rorick that he was associated with, he was on some kind of mission to find Shangri-La, wasn't it, in the mountains of the Himalayas.
Yes, then, you know, Wallace was just a hugely interesting figure. He was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Agriculture, as you mentioned, and later he became Roosevelt's second vice president, immediately preceding Harry Truman. And Wallace was a fascinating man because he was not only an extremely effective Secretary of Agriculture, he's widely considered to have saved thousands of family farms during the Great Depression through certain innovations in farming and agriculture that he promoted. But he very openly was an explorer into mystical and occult religious ideas. He was interested in astrology. He was interested in Native American shamanism. He was a member of the Theosophical Society. He was interested in Tibetan Buddhism at a time when most Americans had never even heard of Tibet. And he did become involved with a Russian artist and intellectual named Nicholas Roerich, as you mentioned. Wallace came to very deeply regret funding a kind of mission that Roerich went on throughout some of the nations of the East. Roerich was supposed to be doing agricultural research. He was supposed to be gathering drought-resistant strains of grass, but he did very little of that. He seemed to be spending his time and the American public's money trying to form some kind of weird, shadowy political and spiritual alliances. He built a small private army or militia for himself briefly while he was on the trip, and it was such an embarrassment that Wallace had to cut all ties with him, and that association eventually cast a shadow over Wallace's political career and eventually contributed to Wallace's downfall when he ran as a third-party left liberal candidate against Harry Truman in 1948.
Now, you argue, and I had not heard this story before, that it was Wallace that convinced FDR to push for putting the Masonic symbol of the pyramid in the eye on the dollar bill. And
yes.
And there was a very specific imagery that they wanted to convey by that.
Yeah, it was very interesting. You know, Wallace approached FDR in 1934 and showed him this very alluring eye and pyramid that was the reverse of the Great Seal of the United States, and it was a symbol that really had just been used for official government business. Most Americans were completely unfamiliar with it. And Wallace was very aroused by it, especially this Latin slogan that surrounds it, which reads, "Annuit coeptus novos ordo seclorum," which can be loosely translated as, "God smiles on our new order of the ages." Wallace felt that the phrase "new order of the ages" was in harmony with what they were attempting to do with the New Deal. Wallace would talk about the need for a New Deal of the ages, this era of spiritual and cultural renewal that he thought was unfolding in America. So Wallace brings this arcane symbol to the attention of FDR. Both men were Freemasons. Both men had a interest in portentous kind of grand symbolism and imagery, and FDR was very turned on by it to the extent that he took Wallace's suggestion that it be placed on the back of our currency. FDR personally called for it being placed on the back of the U.S. dollar bill, and existing notes from the Treasury Department show FDR's handwriting personally supervising the placement of the Iron Pyramid on the back of our bill in 1935. He wanted it to be even though it's the reversed of the Great Seal, FDR placed the image first. If you're reading the bill from left to right, as we normally do, he really wanted to stress and emphasize that image. These men felt it was an image of renewal, a very idealistic image, and they were very excited by it, and thus it became part of our currency.
I think you make the case in the book that we've all been shaped and touched by these different occult currents, but I have a personal connection to it as well, that my mother and grandmother were devotees of Edgar Cayce.
Oh.
And there was a local in Columbus, Ohio, there's a local guy who was a self-styled acolyte of Edgar Cayce, and they took me to him when I was a little boy, and he proclaimed me an old soul. And so there was this strain of occultism in my own family. Eventually, my mother would join the Unity Church, which you also talk about as a kind of occult version of Christianity. But Edgar Cayce, you write, is one of the people who really brought a lot of foundational ideas into popular parlance, like reincarnation that had not really been popular before Cayce.
Yes. Cayce was a man who was reputed to be a clairvoyant, who grew up in backwoods Kentucky in the late 19th century. He lived until the end of the Second World War, and he would go into these trance states in which he would attempt to diagnose and prescribe cures for people's diseases. He gave thousands of trance readings or clairvoyant readings during his lifetime. And, you know, there's a great deal of anecdotal testimony of people who Casey had apparently never met, saying that he cured them of diseases that had resisted years of treatment. And in these trance readings that Casey would give, he would talk about all kinds of different occult and esoteric subjects like astrology, reincarnation, number symbolism, past lives, ideas about Atlantis, and he had this whole mythic reinterpretation of ancient history. And Casey, as you alluded, introduced so many ideas, popularized so many ideas in American culture that were being heard of on a broad scale for the first time. For example, in the 1930s, Casey was probably the first person who prescribed meditation specifically as a stress reliever, specifically as something that could help ease the strains of stress-related diseases. Today, you know, just about everybody walking around out there has heard of things like reincarnation or clairvoyance, has some opinion about it. It was really Casey who began to introduce those terms into the American lexicon for the very first time. His influence is just vast.
In the conclusion of the book, you tell so many stories in there. We have to skip over Psychiana, which was a very important movement, the history of Christian Science and its contentious relationship to the other occult trends of the time. But let's talk about Norman Vincent Peale and this final theme about how contemporary Christianity has imbibed, as opposed to older Christianity, which, you know, could be roughly characterized that we offer you nothing except fire and brimstone and be good. Mm-hmm. Contemporary Christianity had to eventually adopt this Norman Vincent Peale message that the power of positive thinking would have a good effect on your life today. Mm-hmm. Is that the basic upshot of its impact on Christendom?
Yes. You know, I think in a sense, over the last 50 years or so, we've watched American Christianity become transformed from something that had been considered a force for salvation to something that is today considered a force for healing, a force for salvation as well, to be sure. But large American churches today, as almost a matter of course, as almost a prerequisite to attracting a large congregation, address themselves to helping the individual navigate the problems of ordinary daily existence, not just salvation, but self-help, advice, therapy, problem-solving right here in the present. That was probably unknown prior to the Second World War. And one of the things I maintain in the book is that a lot of alternative spiritual movements, a lot of occult and esoteric movements, began to introduce this idea into American culture in the 19th century especially, that religion could be a kind of practical, problem-solving, healing force. And the chief movement that promulgated that idea was the positive thinking movement. And Norman Vincent Peale was a conservative Methodist minister who in 1952 published a mega bestseller called The Power of Positive Thinking, in which he took this prosperity gospel, this positive thinking gospel, stripped it of all magical and occult language, because it really came from areas that were sometimes on the fringes, the religious fringes of American life. Peale took this idea, he recast it in language with which the church-going public could be comfortable, and in doing so, you know, he really created the template for all the self-help and business motivational and religious therapeutic philosophies of our time. So, you know, if you turn on the television on Sunday morning, you'll see a media minister like Joel Osteen just giving these sermons to millions of people over you know the television waves on motivational thinking, positive thinking, causative thinking. Osteen, like Peale before him, is standing directly on the shoulders of what had been an American occult tradition that grew out of different subcultures, particularly in the New England area in the mid-19th century. It's funny, no influence is ever so powerful as the one that you can no longer see. And if you want an example of how a cult or esoteric spirituality entered the mainstream, the whole positive thinking gospel is probably the prime example.
Well, again, this is a fascinating history. We've been talking about Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation by Mitch Horowitz, who's an editor at the Torture Penguin book series and a writer on the occult for many years. And you can find him at mitchhorowitz.com. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.